Craig joined the COPD Foundation, and he is the CEO and executive director of the COPD Foundation. He joined them in 2013. He has over 25 years of experience in the healthcare sector as a clinician, a senior-level business leader, and successful entrepreneur. He began his career as a registered respiratory therapist and has worked in hospital settings as a clinician and administrator. After leaving the hospital setting, he began his business career in the respiratory durable medical equipment field. In addition to his clinical experience, he has management responsibilities in a variety of operational and developmental roles, including sales and marketing and so forth. So Craig today is going to talk about today's healthcare issues, implications for COPD patients and caregivers.
Thank you, Winston. So I'm going to apologize up front. I never do this, but I may have to refer to notes of this. Our senior director of policy and outcomes, Jamie Sullivan, typically does this presentation, and she's our expert at this. So she would wow you with all of this without ever having to look at a slide. Unfortunately, I'm not quite as fluent in the language as she is, but I'm using her presentation. So Jamie, if you are listening to this recorded, my apologies for butchering your presentation. So let's talk a little bit about COPD. So we've heard earlier, you know, everyone knows that COPD and cigarettes have a very strong causal link, right? There are a few numbers I want to share with you, though, that sort of broaden the definition, because one of the things I think we struggle with in creating awareness and creating engagement within the COPD community is the stigmatization and the fact that, well, this is a smoker's disease and therefore I brought it on myself, and so I'll be, you know, as Kate said, you know, I'm going to be self-conscious, and or, the public viewing and say, well, you did this to yourself, so, you know, why should we really be that emotionally engaged with COPD? 70% of the people who smoke never get COPD, all right? So right there tells you that there is something in addition to the fact that you smoke that's going on there. We know that 25% of the people who report a diagnosis of COPD have never smoked. Now that's an interesting one, right? Because how do you get COPD if you never smoked? Oh, well, a coal miner. Okay, fine, we can take out that subset. Obviously, exposure to other sort of pollutants and things that might cause an inflammatory response in the lung. But what I'm really getting at is that through our COPD gene study, we have really been looking at the impact of genetics on COPD and the impact that has on your likelihood to get COPD. And we do believe that there's a strong link between some sort of genetic predisposition. So COPD is something more than just a disease that we bring on ourselves through bad choices and bad lifestyle choices. I believe the data I'm using here is probably from a little bit older study than Winston's. You know, 32 billion, I think this came from a 2008 global impact study or something like that, a global burden study. What I can say is that when you factor in things such as absenteeism, we're upwards of 70 to 80 billion. And that's not even including what we now talk about, which is presenteeism. And that's the fact that an individual with COPD who's getting sick and having an exacerbation isn't really totally productive for the week or so leading up to their usually a trip to the emergency department or to their physicians. And then, of course, we have the time that they're treating their exacerbation, which again, they may be off work or extremely low, and then there's a little bit of a recovery time. So absenteeism, presenteeism are something that are really factoring into what we talk to employers about. 16 million lost days of work. Again, those are just days where they're absent. Those are sick days, not counting days that they're calling in. So this is we think that one of the strategies that we might all employ to get a little more traction out there is through the employer groups. And if we look at the BRFIS data, we see that about 70% of the people with COPD are under age 65 and therefore theoretically still within the workforce. Now we know there's a fairly high incidence of disability within that group, but still this is a disease that has a big impact on employers and productivity in the U.S. The other thing that I will tell you is that if we stopped smoking today, if we magically could wave the wand and there were no more cigarettes, 20 years from now, we will still be dealing with a significant burden of COPD. Because as was pointed out, this is one of the, if not the, maybe the only disease that has not been declining, of the chronic prevalent diseases, that's not been declining over time. And we know that there are close ties with asthma and with other sort of factors. So this isn't going to go away. As was mentioned earlier, COPD is really a multi-system disease. It very rarely occurs purely. And even in the individuals with pure genetically caused emphysema, they are always at some point starting to experience, you know, certainly the depression, but then further on cardiovascular involvement. So we see depression, arthritis, diabetes, myocardial infarction, and stroke as being highly correlated with COPD. And that's one of the things that makes it a little bit difficult. I think with some of the diagnoses, you know, we know that there's a, you know, bunch of people out there running around with heart disease diagnoses who also have COPD diagnoses. And so, you know, getting a good diagnosis has been difficult for our community. But yet, you've heard we're third leading cause of death, second leading cause of disability, increasing cause of mortality amongst women, yet there are no federal dollars appropriated for this. There's no national action plan. So therefore, there's no money within the CDC to create a program. And so that really gives us limited inclusion at the state level, outside of some of the things that you've heard about from these gentlemen, where we get some champions and some public health folks like yourself who are interested and want to pick up and carry the torch. So what we're left with is a federal response that's really been focused on clean air and tobacco usage, okay? And that's great because we want to start with the prevention. You know, if we can get people to quit smoking, if we can, make sure our air is clean and people are protected from other environmental pollutants, that's going to help us in the future. What this ignores is the 15 million diagnosed and the additional, you know, 12 to 15 million people undiagnosed or underdiagnosed living today with COPD, and the fact that as those people age into a higher burden of disease, we're facing a really big public health problem here. And lots of dollars and lots of resources are going to be spent on it if we don't get the awareness to start focusing on helping the people who are living with COPD today, not just trying to prevent it in the future. Even within the NIH, if you look at this, we look at where funding goes and what kills us, okay? You see where COPD, you know, has extremely high mortality rate, yet it, I believe, is number 14 on the funding list at NIH. Where we see, you know, other diseases, which are, again, you know, I don't want to downplay the importance of addressing those diseases as well. But as a public health issue, we really need to recalibrate how we're looking at addressing the burden of these big chronic diseases. So our goal, you know, what are we advocating? It really is to try and put together a national coordinated response. And if we could get all of the different agencies that have a stake, all of the different organizations that would have a stake in this together, working towards some common goals, we could really make a difference in probably a pretty short term. Data collection, number one. You saw what was in North Carolina was able to be done with data, okay? Just by being able to slice and dice and focus and then go in with an action plan and move the needle. It can be done. Certainly prevention, which I think we're down the pathway on. Education, awareness, treatment. I think this is where I get on my soapbox a little bit as a respiratory therapist. If we could get those individuals who are currently living with COPD into proper treatment pathways, which really, it's not that tough. It's proper and appropriate timing of medications, and it's pulmonary rehab. I mean, really. Those are the two things. Probably if you had a third educational layer, it would be recognizing exacerbations and treating exacerbations before they start to, you know, before they get out of hand. And it's not just the, you know, that we want to avoid the cost of a hospitalization or cost of an emergency room visit. But every time you have an exacerbation, you're causing more lung destruction, and you never get that back. So, you know, the frequent pattern of exacerbations is what puts these people on the downward slope. So, and then ultimately research, and hopefully at the end of this I'll have a moment to touch on something that we're doing called COPD 360, which will be very exciting for research. So the National Action Plan, if we could get everyone to do that, really we could look at four chunks of action. And, you know, certainly having more money to be able to drive awareness. What if we had billboards throughout the nation? You know, I love that. Smoke pigs, not cigs. That was good. Okay. Practice changes, earlier diagnosis, as we talked about. You know, you would be amazed at the gold standard for diagnosing COPD is a simple breathing test called a spirometry. Has everyone had one? You take a deep breath, you blow through a thing, and that's it. All right? And we can diagnose COPD with that. Yet, the majority of primary care physicians do not do spirometry when they diagnose. If you look at the number of individuals who claim they have a diagnosis and don't have a spirometry, it's astounding. So, again, we're almost in the dark ages when it comes to diagnosing and then getting these people set forth on the proper pathways. Public and private policies that will ensure access and create quality care. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the access issues that we're starting to see as a result of sort of the two-edged sword, which was ACA. Okay? And then, of course, everything's data-driven these days, and the capabilities that we have now to use data in order to make some meaningful inroads into this disease are truly astonishing. Unfortunately, we're kind of stuck at, you know, the first two levels on our approach here. Because we don't have this national action plan and because we don't have the type of funding, you know, most often it is small awareness campaigns and ceremonial actions as we get declarations from governors and those types of things. What we need to do now is make the step up, and this is where we need everyone's help here. And that is getting commitments for action within the states. And it really does need to start at the state level and work its way up. This probably is not going to be a top-down initiative. But ultimately, the funds will flow if we can build the awareness, if we can get people to take commitments to action. So, you know, here's a list of some of the things that, you know, you could look at. I'm not going to go through each and every one of them because I think we can, there's a couple other points I want to make. But it's really, you can download this afterwards. It's kind of a list. But it really starts with finding legislators that will help it, agencies that want to get involved, and just building up that line of actions till we get to the point where we have some money that flows with this. Some of the things that we're monitoring that I want to make you all aware of, access to therapies. This is something that is really emerging as a big problem for our community, and it's because of the Affordable Care Act. On one hand, the Affordable Care Act was wonderful for our community because it eliminates pre-existings, it eliminates lifetime caps, we have guaranteed issue insurance, so our community can get coverage. But coverage isn't care, right? And what we're seeing now is because there's such a focus on cost containment that all of the old, all of the old methodologies for containing costs, which is limiting choice, mainly, okay, and limiting access are being put into place. We're finding individuals now constantly being denied one drug because it's not the top formulary drug within their PBM. And as you know, all medicine is personal, right? And we find within our community that even though there are comparable drugs, not everything works the same way. Kate's shaking her head. She hears this all the time, right? Not every drug works the same way. And so our community needs choice. To be able to do that. Access to oxygen, as reimbursement rates have declined, those individuals who use liquid oxygen, who tend to be are more severe and tend to then become less mobile because they don't have access to liquid because it's being phased out. Electronic cigarettes, I won't get into. That's a double-edged sword. We'd love to see people use them as a way to quit smoking, but we also think they're not good because they're a gateway for a whole new generation of people who think it's cool to puff on something that's not a cigarette, but it's still nicotine. And then finally, we don't know what the agents that are in that vapor are going to do over the long term. And then another positive, I think, that came out of healthcare reform, though, was the establishment of PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Institute. And we are one of the 18 patient-powered research networks that have been launched as a result of that. We do have a caucus. What's interesting, if you look at where these individuals are from and you match them up with the high incidence states that you saw there, there's a little disparity there. So, you know, there's some opportunity there. Advocacy achievements, I'm not going to talk about. I do want to talk quickly about PPRN. We've undertaken a very, very big challenge, and that is to find and recruit 75,000 individuals with COPD into a patient-powered registry. Okay, so this is a patient registry, patient-centered. It's the initial enrollment and the initial surveys are patient-reported outcomes. Phase two will be the importation of their EMR data into this. But we're using this as the basis to create the largest registry in the world of individuals with COPD, with patient-reported outcomes, with some characterization from medical records, hopefully imaging data in the future. We believe this allows us then to basically employ the cancer model, which is subphenotype COPD into its different types, genetically caused, bronchiectasis, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, you know, there may be five or six more that we do. But we really think that establishing this registry built upon this patient-powered research network is our pathway to a cure. So if you can help us spread the word about this, we would be forever grateful and our community would be forever grateful. So I got 30 seconds left. The last thing I want to mention then is we just launched a new, it's called COPD 360. A new program. And COPD 360, half of it has to do with the research side. The front end has to do with connecting our community. As Kate said, there is a lot of isolationism that goes on. We're using the power of social media, and we've created an extremely robust new online community, which we did a soft launch on 2 weeks ago. I think we're up to 500 people that have signed up without telling anybody about it. And it combines all of the best things that you've seen out there. So it's a Facebook with a Patients Like Me capability where patients can go in and they can input their drugs, their symptoms, where they live, whatever they want to share about themselves. The database checks itself and says, here's 12 other people who have very similar characteristics you might want to talk to or connect with. It's also a portal for collecting our patient-reported outcomes. It's also a portal for delivering education and support materials and connectivity. So, and then finally, it's really the beginnings of our organizing our community for advocacy. Because imagine if we could push a button and get 1 million patients with COPD to contact their state legislator or contact, you know, a policy official. The power that we would have to be able to move our community forward and to make all your jobs a little bit easier, I think would be substantial. So please point people towards us, join the community, and thank you very much.